You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to another edition of the Dogger Pass Podcast. This for UFC Mexico City, Paul Shaughnessy in studio. Producer Megan on the sticks. Cody Saftick is on the line. The regular band, pretty much every single week, is back together here. This episode of the Dogger Pass Podcast. And this is the last episode of the Dogger Pass Podcast. It's brought to you by Prize Picks. Use promo code DOP when making a new account to get a match up to $100. On your first deposit. Cody, it was good that I went on vacation because I would have got slapped even harder on last week's card.
Really?
I had Volk in the main event. I mean, I ended up being less invested than I would have been. But yeah, I lost some money. A little bit of money.
Really?
But yeah, if I was around, I would have lost a lot more money. So
See, so I don't see how that was. Last week was probably my best week of the season. We're on officially a 2-week win streak to move our overall record on 3-2 on the year. But again, it's a streak now. But last week went like exceedingly well. Had Volk won, yeah, then we would have hit four lines and a plus 1200 ticket on top of the top three. But last week there was 12 fights and 11 favorites won. I shot for four underdogs. Those four underdogs all lost. But then luckily for me, they were like all the bottom picks. But yeah, everybody that needed to win won. You know, Robert Whittaker came through. I know you were hating on Ian Gary, but I ended up taking him by decision.
I didn't hate on him. I actually picked him and I said, I hope he loses, but that I liked him.
I was telling people that all week. Like, yeah, man, I hope he loses. But then when it comes down to it and you're sweating parlay tickets, you're like, please God, just let this fool win one more time. One more time. The next time I'll fade him. He can lose, but this time right here, just let him win. Anyways, he wins. There was a bunch of close fights, but at the end of the day, like those that key 6-1, even like O'Bannon, like there was like some greasy picks to start out the card. Got the job done. Quinlan got knocked out, never been knocked out before. Got knocked out on that prop in terms of hand of God getting it done. So yeah, it was solid week. This week, way difficult. I mean, it's another card that looks like mostly favorites. I can't identify a whole bunch of favorites that I would say I love, but there's definitely some key underdogs here that probably are going to come out and win. There's also a nice looking LFA card on the Friday, the PFL versus Bellator card on the Saturday.
It's a loaded week.
This card on the Friday as well. Uriah Faber's A1 fights like on the Thursday. There's just so many fights this week that I'm super excited to break down these fights with you. But I think I'm going to be a little smart with my bankroll management this week. In terms of UFC fights, maybe just pick and choose what I really like because it's kind of a trappy card. But it's a trappy card I hope to hit a PRP on. And we're going to do our damnedest to get it done. But reality says better to just pick and choose from all of these other cards and make something safe than, you know, forcing a couple spots on this one.
100%. Yeah, buddy, it was, for what I had done the previous week, it was an absolute drop in the bucket. So, like, there's 0-0 stress. And as I said, it was like, yeah, I had Barlow by knockout. That was, like, the only bet that I made that actually
Barlow,
won.
Yeah.
But, no, like, zero sweat off my back, to be perfectly honest. Let's move into UFC Mexico City. We got Brandon Moreno taking on Brandon Royval. Battle of the Brandons. It's the second time that they are fighting each other. Moreno is a minus 300 favorite. Royval can be had for plus 240. I mean, the first time that they fought each other, I feel like Brandon Moreno was getting the better of the exchanges. He found three takedowns. He had no real problem with Brandon Royval's guard. Obviously, it was an unfortunate situation where Royval's shoulder pops out literally with like a second left. In between that and the judge's, official decision or whatever, His coach is able to like pop his shoulder back in, so potentially he could have fought, but he still looked like he was in pain. One of those freak injuries, but like from what we saw, I mean, I can't really fault the line for being where it is. Like, I feel like Brandon Moreno is kind of a terrible matchup for Royval. Royval's got some sneaky submissions. I mean, he got Moreno into a bit of a guillotine when he was shooting for a takedown early on, but Moreno was able to get out of that. And frankly, it's like Moreno's just cast iron. The chin is just so solid. It's like, I don't really know if Moreno can, or if Royval can do much to really rattle him in that respect. Minus 300 is minus 300. I don't think it's going to be a shoulder injury round one finish by any stretch of the imagination this time around. I wouldn't be surprised for a Moreno by decision, to be perfectly honest, after seeing, you know, Royval kind of prove that he's been working on that cardio, able to go the distance. I'm not concerned about these guys at altitude, to be perfectly honest, because Royval did show us against Pantoja. It's like he's been working on that. He slowed down a little bit in the later rounds, but a lot of his like cardio issues were definitely overblown. He's made a lot of improvements, but I think Brandon Moreno gets it done again. What about you?
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and agree. So I'm a big Brandon Royval fan, and I don't think he's got cardio issues. The guy pushes a hell of a pace, trains at altitude to begin with, and I think generally has good cardio. It's more of a bit of a durability issue. Like, he can put some absolute heat on opponents, but when they return fire, whether it be an injury, whether it be, you know, he gives up his back in a scrambling, gives up a submission, whether it be he gets rocked in a fight, the longer these fights go, these higher level, super high class fights, the more, you know, he'll have some vulnerabilities here and there. But I actually did pick him to upset Pantoja in his last fight. Came in kind of a bit of a wild card, big underdog. You know he's going to bring it. You know he's in the first fight against Pantoja, he was doing really well before he got caught in that rear naked choke. I think there's a lot to like about Brandon Royval. Thing is that he showed in that Pantoja fight, Paul, is that his takedown defense is a serious problem.
Bad.
It's 40% in the UFC, but everybody takes him down. And I wouldn't say it's bad because he's fighting legitimately good guys, but they're all taking him down. Pantoja got him down 8 times. Previous to that, Rogerio Bontorin had taken him down 8 times. Pantoja, the first time they fought, had taken him down 3 times. Moreno took him down twice. Tim Elliott back in the day took him down 4 times. You can look at some fights and be like, oh, Matheus Nicolau never took him down. Matt Schnell never took him down. Kaikar France never took him down. None of those guys actually shot any attempts. Kaikar France is credited with one because he was rocked and he tried to grab a hold of him. But none of those other guys shot a takedown. The guys that want to wrestle Royval clearly are going to be able to do that. Now, he's got a nasty guard. He's got a decent get-up game. He's got this crazy cardio. He's always throwing. Even in that Pantoja fight, he landed 55 significant strikes in the fifth round. Fifth round. He landed more in the fifth round than he did in the previous four. So you know he's a dog. You know he's going to be there, but the ability to take him down in the first four rounds and hold him down is a problem. Then you brought up that cast iron durability of Moreno, and that's going to be kryptonic to his game as well, because that quick knockout that he might be able to catch you with, that quick guillotine choke he might be able to catch you with, highly unlikely that he's submitting or knocking out Brandon Moreno, and so he's going to have to dogfight him for 5 rounds. And in a 5-round dogfight, they're both going to be landing. But Moreno's ability to mix in those takedowns is what's going to secure it in front of a hometown crowd, a Mexican hometown crowd. Like, they're going to be hot. They're going to be in for their fighter, and the who knows who's judging these fights. But you would assume that there's going to be a bit of a hometown bias there. All I'm saying is that, yeah, Moreno seems to be it. Now, is the line a little bit too much? Maybe. But keep this in consideration. Moreno is getting ready to take on Amir Albazi in this spot. Albazi pulls out. And you got Royval coming in on short notice. Not only is Royval coming in on short notice for a fight that's a mile high in the air and 5 rounds against a guy that already beat you who can easily fight 25 minutes on a bad day, on top of all those things, is he literally just fought like 8 weeks ago, 5 rounds against Pantoja. He fought late December, and now he's getting a quick February turnaround. Like, I don't know. I don't know. The deck is stacked against him, certainly. So Moreno's the favorite. Is he this big of a favorite? It's justifiable. It's justifiable. And I'm not going to play contrarian. I'll take the favorite.
Yeah. I mean, the saving grace, I suppose, for Royval is that he trains in Denver. I know it's only the Mile High City, and Mexico City is like the 2 mile high city. It's like 10,000 feet altitude. It's insane. But
10,000 compared to 8,000. So yeah, it's like 2,000 more, I'm pretty sure.
Sure. But at the end of the day, yeah, it's like that I feel like at least living up there, training up there, coming off of the couch, I would be a little bit more concerned about someone who trains in Florida and lives in Florida and, like, you know, takes this opportunity on really short notice. I think that would be a bigger red flag, you know, and, like, you start questioning whether they're down there adapting to the climate and stuff. Like, I remember I went out to Whistler for a buddy's bachelor party, and, like, by no means am I, you know, a peak physical specimen like these two gentlemen. But, buddy, like, I went skiing, felt sore, and just, like, I just felt like I never really healed until I got back to, like, the East Coast here. You know what I mean? It's like my muscles were sore, but it's like because you're not gaining enough oxygen, you just never really, like, feel, you know, it's just like you never really felt, I never really felt better. Like, I went back out a couple times skiing, but it was just like an absolute bloodbath. But I'm old and broken, so these guys are young in the primes of their life. Maybe it's a bit of a stretch for me to compare myself to them. We move on. We've got Yair Rodriguez taking on Brian Ortega. Yair Rodriguez is a -150 favorite. Ortega can be had for +130. I mean, these guys obviously fought. The shoulder injury that happened between these guys seemed even more fluky, perhaps. Like, Ortega was having a lot of success in round one there. He was fighting the type, like, if you were going to back Brian Ortega, he's fighting the exact kind of fight that you want. You know that this guy's cast iron. His chin is legendary. The striking has kind of come along over the years, but he was fighting so smart. It's like he was staying inside of kicking range. He was like, he'll eat some jabs to land some hooks, you know, stay right in the pocket, keep backing Yair up, keep backing him up. And then he held him up against the cage a little bit, like, you know, take all of your opponent's best weapons away. Like, rewatching that this afternoon before coming in here, I was just like, my biggest question of why it may be hard to pull the trigger on Brian Ortega is obviously he had that shoulder injury. It's been a year and a half off. So I will pick him for the purposes of this show, but I am considering actually backing Brian Ortega. I'll probably wait for weigh-ins just to make sure, I don't know, everything kind of adds up, everything looks right, but I don't know. I liked what I saw from him in that fight. If I back Brian Ortega, the way he fought before he got injured there is exactly what I want him to do against Yair Rodriguez. So Ortega is the pick for me. What about you?
Yeah, like, want to pick Ortega. Think I might pick Ortega. If I got a gun to my head, take a couple underdogs on this card. Ortega certainly is one that is looking appealing. But, dude, it would be a total shot-in-the-dark wild card pick. Like, mm-hmm. You mentioned, he's been off a year and a half, which is an issue on itself. He is 33 years old, so it's not like he's super young. The year and a half long layoff due to injury, getting into his mid-30s, let's say. He's lost his last two fights. He's 1-3 over his last four fights. It's not been a great run, let's say. And on top of that, it's like he hasn't finished an opponent in 6 years, right? He hasn't won a fight in like 3.5 years. He hasn't finished an opponent in 6 years. Those wins, you know, whether it be Frankie Edgar or Korean Zombie, like none of those didn't age well. The win over Moicano aged well from 2017, but you'll remember that fight. He lost the first two rounds and caught him in the third. So you're putting a lot of faith in what's not there. Like, he was a top contender 4 or 5 years ago. He's beating relevant names, or even those guys were in the tail end of their careers, truth be told. But at least he was beating some of the top-ish guys back then, but then stepped up against Max Holloway. He took a life-changing beating. Maxed up against Alexander Volkanovski. He had a couple moments with the guillotine and the triangle, but outside of that, he took a relative beating. And then the Yair Rodriguez fight, yeah, he was doing good, and then he got hurt. And then there's a layoff. So to just assume he's going to come back as some reinvented version of himself or a peak version, he's fighting in Mexico City against, you know, a former interim champion, a top three guy in the division. It's a very difficult fight to come back to. They're not doing him any favors saying, you know, here's a softish opponent, beat him, then we'll throw you into the fire. He's just going right back into the fire. Never left it, but just going right back into it. So again, it's a disadvantaged position for sure, but I picked him against Yair Rodriguez the first time. I think he matches up incredibly well with him. He's got solid striking. His jiu-jitsu is second to none. And even though his wrestling's not good enough to take down guys like Alexander Volkanovski, it is, in fact, good enough to take down Yair Rodriguez. And he did take him down. And he did land some good strikes. And he was doing good. And he looked like the rightful favorite. And he got hurt. So, yeah, I get it. It's a year and a half long layoff. You're coming back. Now you're the underdog. You were the favorite the first time around. Unfortunate injury. but you were the favorite because of your skills. Those skills didn't digress, I don't think. 33 is not super old. So as long as he comes back with that solid chin and that solid cardio and that ability to keep pace with Yair Rodriguez, he's going to present a lot of problems, both standing and on the ground. So don't mind that. Next thing is that Brian Ortega is a weird dude. Like, I was a fan of him. Then he makes some stupid comments and he became a recluse. But I'm going to give the guy props, right? He comes from a bit of a tough upbringing, very blue collar, you know, gang-related stuff. Everybody knows the story. Becomes a contender or becomes a jiu-jitsu guy. And gets to like the highest part. Gets really good at jiu-jitsu. Unbelievably good in a short period of time. Because that's his focus, is jiu-jitsu. Jumps over to MMA and it's like he's mostly just a jiu-jitsu guy. He had lost the first two rounds against Clay Guida. He had lost the first two rounds against Thiago Tavares. He lost the first two rounds against Renato Moicano. And he beat all three of those guys in the third round. Because it's like he's learning on the fly. But after he got absolutely smoked by Max Holloway, he took a year and a half off. And I remember he did this interview where he's like, I had to cut out a bunch of friends from my friend circle. And I moved in with my boxing coach and I just did nothing but box for 8 months, 10 months. The very next fight after the Max Holloway beating, he comes back with just a completely revamped boxing game, murders the Korean Zombie, lands like 140 significant strikes, took him down three times, just looked unbelievable version of him. And then gave Volkanovski a go, a prime Volkanovski a go. You know, it was looking good against Yair. And now, so most people are going to be afraid from this year and a half long layoff. I honestly believe Brian Ortega, if he just focused on his skills, he could come back as a better version, if not the same version. The same version is going to be competitive. A better version wins this fight. Both versions, you're getting plus 130 underdog status on it. Dog or pass, I'll take the dog, Brian Ortega.
Nice. All right, moving on down. We've got Daniel Zellhuber taking on Francisco Prado. Minus 260 for Zellhuber. Prado can be had for plus 220. Who you got?
Yeah, so good fight, tough fight. It seems to me like Francisco Prado is a big power puncher, right? I mean, he needs to land those big shots, right? He's not exactly the best wrestler. You saw in his Jamie Mularkey fight, taken down three times, largely controlled. If you don't give him that ability to land that chopping overhand, right? If you don't stand directly in front of him, you can neutralize this guy, not easily, but it's the path of least resistance. His last time out against Otman Azitar is also a stand in front of you banger. It's just the way he fights. He's a little bit older now. He stands in front of Prado. Prado beats him to the punch and puts him down. This fight with Daniel Zellhuber, you know, you and I always talk about this cast iron Mexican toughness. And the thing with Zellhuber is that he's got a hell of a chin on him. He can take a punch. He's got good volume. And he's willing to stand there long enough to maybe take one to give you back two or three. That volume game will eventually overtake you. He looked awesome on the Contender Series. Foolishly enough, I thought the kid was the real deal. I bet him fairly heavy against Trey Ogden. And he did not show up against Trey Ogden. But in his two subsequent fights, Lando Venon and his last time out against Christos Giagos, you're seeing why they call him the Golden Boy. He's very young. He's been full-time in Las Vegas for a long, long time now. The skills are very much developing all across the map. And now that he's getting some confidence, some wins in the UFC, again, you're going to see a continuously better version of him every time he comes out. This matchup, in particular against Francisco Prado, if Prado nails him with that shot, I feel like Zellhuber just rolls with it. He can take a few of them, but the superior volume will be coming from Zellhuber. The superior range will be coming from Zellhuber. And kid's actually got a pretty decent little ground game on him. Against that fight with Giagos, you saw his striking, but to land that Anaconda choke second round, very, very slick stuff. I think, again, in this transition of him making that progress, I think you see him use his volume, his speed, his length, maybe mix in a takedown and use some grappling as well. But Zellhuber should be the clear favorite, which he is, and I'm going to be backing him.
Watching some of it back, like I think Zellhuber, like I'm obviously super, super young. He's got insane, like he's insanely big for the division. What is he, like 6'1" with like a 77-inch reach? He's got a lot of intangibles. The submission win against our last time out there was impressive, but like even in round one, Giagos rocks him. Rocks him hard. The kid they keep complimenting on being able to like maintain that reach, maintain that length. It's like he gets clipped. He got clipped against Lucas Almeida. It's like, I know we always joke about, you know, he's Mexican. And the chin has held up. He hasn't got flat knocked down. But he's shown in multiple fights here. It's like he kind of keeps that chin up. The striking defense is not optimal, to be perfectly honest. I think Prado could cause him a lot of problems, and I would not fault anyone, including myself, who's eyeballing it right now. for taking a shot on Prado KO1, 13-1. Because, I mean, I think if it comes down to this going to decision, let's face it, at the end of the day, both of these guys are super young. They're both improving every single fight. Does Zell Huber have way more intangibles, unteachables, in the fact that he's super, super long, good technique? He's got, like, they're both very, very good prospects, in my opinion, to be perfectly honest. I liked Prado before the Malarkey fight. I thought he showed a lot of heart just being able to kind of hang in there, really, really short notice, basically like taking that fight just to be, you know, to get a spot on the roster, and then came through and showed what he's actually usually about with the first round knockout last time out. But I don't know. Zell Huber's kind of shown us a few times that, like, that chin is a little bit sketchy as far as I'm concerned. It may not be a chin, but it's just like his... He takes big shots, and maybe they'll clean that up, and he'll get even better at utilizing that reach, like at like 23 years old. Like, he has a lot of potential, don't get me wrong. I'm probably going to bet this right now, this Prado KO1 plus 1300, because at one of the sharper books, they opened it at 1300. And it went down to 800 real quick. So I'm going to be jumping on that. I'll pick, for the purpose of a pick, I'll pick Prado as well. But yeah, I'm not going to be shocked if he loses on the money line. Don't even, I have no real intentions on touching the money line, to be perfectly honest. But that prep, him by KO, him by KO1, they have my attention.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Moving on down, we got Raul Rosas Jr. taking on Ricky Tercios. Raul Rosas is a minus 210 favorite. Tercios can be had for plus 180. Who you got?
Yeah, I'm probably going to take a bath on this one. Just, you know, overplaying Rosas. And why would you want to bet this 19-year-old kid and, you know, goofy personality and still very green in a lot of ways. So, like, I could see Rosas definitely being the apple pie shitter for one Cody Saftick personally this weekend. But just like, yeah, dude, styles make fights. And I think he's got a really good style to go out and beat Ricky Tercios. Again, when you look at him and just like how young he is, 19 years old, every time he fights, he's going to be vastly better than the last time. He's putting his skills together. I think him losing to Christian Rodriguez isn't a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's a reality check. You lose that undefeated record, which takes pressure off your shoulders and allows you to go to the drawing board and realize what you got to do. He almost choked out Christian Rodriguez with a rear naked choke. And for the record, Rodriguez is on a hell of a tear, man. He goes out and beats Cameron Simon his last time out. Now he's booked against Isaac Dalgarian. So, like, he's where he wants to be. He's fighting legitimate prospects. He's giving them a go. It's that inexperience and that youthfulness is playing against him. Now, yes, still 19 years old. He's still going to be making mistakes, no doubt about it. But them giving him Ricky Tercios is almost them trying to help him out. Rosas, yeah, okay, he caught Mitchell his last time out. But he's not a power puncher. He's a grappler, very much so. They call the Mexican Khabib. He wants to chain wrestle, wants to stick tight to the hips, and he wants to just rinse and repeat, get you up against the cage, peel you to the ground, take your back. It's what he does exceptionally well. Even in his loss, that's his position. That's where he usually finds himself, and that's where you're going to have trouble. I'm a little bit worried about him at altitude simply because he's young. He fights pedal to the metal, like he's going 100% all the time, whereas sometimes you need to pace yourself, sometimes you need to relax. And so if Tercios, who is a wily veteran, a guy that can fight 15 minutes, a guy that will give you a go and give you a stern test, that guy doesn't go away and he's there for 15, I need Rosas to also be there for 15. But again, looking at Ricky Tercios, Paul, here's a guy that lost to Boston Salmon on the Contender Series, right? He usually gets to where he wants to be, that big fight, can't quite get over the hump. UFC re-signs him, he fights Brady Heestand. Brady Heestand's like 22 years old when he fought him. He was also young. He's a wrestler half as good as Rosas. And yet, yeah, he took him down six times, gave him a tough fight. His last time out against Kevin Natividad, he's a massive favorite over Kevin Natividad. He's supposed to walk right through him. He gets dropped. He He gave up 7 takedowns to Kevin Thibodeau. So everyone that pretty much wants to take him down is going to take him down. I think Rosas Jr. is the same. He wants him down, he's going to take him down. The difference is those guys are looking to take you down, hold half guard, land some chopping elbows. Rosas is looking to take your back, backpack you, and control you. He gassed out doing it against Christian Rodriguez, but again, taking the valuable lesson from that fight, if he can just backpack Ricky Turcios and not gas out, he's not going anywhere, man. He'll get the takedowns when he wants them. He'll get his position when he wants them. It's whether he gasses out if Ricky's able to survive for the 15 minutes. So this is a good fight because it's going to give you some ring time. It's going to give you some experience, but it's a favorable matchup with you, right? So even if Ricky stuffs the takedowns and keeps it standing, he's not that big of a threat on the feet. He's got some nasty volume, sure, but Rosas has got some, I don't know, I can't even say he's got okay volume. He doesn't really throw that much. He just power handles you to the ground and then out grapples you. Again, I think the UFC knows what they're doing on a matchmaking perspective, and it's one that favors Rosas. So there's a ton of big favorites this weekend. Rosas is like a mid-level favorite, minus 270 range, compared to some of these minus 400, minus 500 type guys. So in some spots for parlays, he will juice it up, but he's 19 years old, dude. So that's what's causing me to not like want to put him at the top. He probably ends up on the second line, to be quite honest with you. But there's a bit of a hesitancy to put him, you know, put too much stock in him and too much faith in him. Because like, I remember what I was doing at 19. And like, you would not want to have any faith in a 19-year-old Cody. I don't know that I wanted a bunch of faith in Jay Leno's illegitimate Mexican love child. 1,000 feet in the air, right? 10,000 feet in the air.
10,000 feet in the air. It's a lot of feet. Here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. I mean, Ricky Turcios, the first two fights, obviously, 110 against Boston Salmon, 100 significant strikes against Brady Hestand. Then 27 against Eamon Zahabi. Zahabi does slow down the pace of a fight. But it's just like, I don't know. You listen to this guy on an interview, and it sounds like he's on ayahuasca. Like, guy's a lunatic. And at the end of the day, what this fight really comes down to is that he couldn't stuff a Thanksgiving turkey, let alone a takedown from Raul Rosas Jr. He got taken down 7 times by Kevin Natividad. He got taken down 6 times by Brady Hystand. Raul Rosas will get the takedowns early and often, and I mean, Turcios hasn't really been subbed, so probably it'll be kind of similar, I think, for Raul Rosas. Maybe it goes to the full decision. Terrence Mitchell is a guy that you get out of there early. You know, that's just the way the Terrence Mitchell experience is. But I don't know. It could be one of those types of situations where just so much positional dominance, so much strength advantage, he kind of pounds away, and it's kind of like a mercy stoppage type of thing. But yeah, I think the safer approach is just to take Raul Rosas Jr. plus 210. I actually don't even think it's all that crazy. He's going to get takedowns. And when he gets those takedowns, he's going to control significant portions of this fight in front of his hometown crowd or his home country crowd. We'll see how much they love him out there. I don't know. Like, I know the American public, not the biggest fan. They kind of think he's an annoying kid. A little bit too cocky, yada, yada, yada. He's probably a star down there, though. I guess we'll find out. But yeah, no, honestly, man, I think he's a fine parlay piece this week. The takedown advantage should just be so crystal clear for him in this fight. We got Yasmin Origi taking on Sam Page, Sam Hughes. Minus 520 for Origi, plus 400 for Sam Page. So here's the thing about this fight, Code. I think the one thing about Origi that we kind of saw is that, like, durability may be a bit of a question mark. I mean, Denise Gomes absolutely lit her up, got her out of there. 17 significant strikes in, like, 20 seconds. Just went, like, absolute assault rifle on her. Got her out of there really quick. The durability may not be great. Takedown defense, it could be a little bit of a question. I don't know. Yasmin Lucindo is, like, the only person who really tried. She tried twice in round 2. Of their fight, and she was stuffed both times. There is probably a path for Sam Page, but Sam Page can't bust a grate. And I feel like that's probably, until further notice, until we, I guess, get a little bit more information about Origi, I feel like that may be the only path, is like strawweight knockouts against her. The other skills all seem to be there for her. She should have a massive advantage on the feet. I mean, I feel like if you were going to bet Sam Page, unless you really think that there's a massive wrestling disparity here, I would probably play the safer approach. You're not, you know, if the fight starts and Sam Page gets a takedown immediately, you're not getting the 400 anymore. But maybe you get like plus 300 when she's like hanging out in guard, if you wanted to go down that route. I just don't really have the answer for like, is she going to be able to get the takedowns? I will take the coward's way out. I will take Yasmin Wariki as a pick here. I think this is a fight that I'm more interested in a live betting perspective, though. What about you?
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I think I might take Sam Hughes. Oh, if for baby. No other reason than the price tag is just ridiculous, Paul. Pat Mayo would be the first one to tell you this one fits the CF dot model to a T, right? There's a lot of variables. It's a relatively close fight when you think about it. And yes, Sam Hughes has a path of victory, and this is a crazy price tag. Let me tell you something about Sam Hughes, okay? Sam Hughes, 3-4 in the UFC, okay? Sam Hughes, 7-fight UFC veteran. All 7 fights, she's been the betting underdog, and yet she's won 3 of them. But keep this in mind. She debuts against Tisha Torres, who's a former title, like, not a title challenger, but a top 5 girl. But anyways, debut against Tisha Torres, she's a plus 440 underdog. Whoa, unheard of. Second fight in the UFC against Loma Lugbume, she's a plus 310 underdog. Who's matchmaking for this poor girl? But they give her a third fight against Luana Pinheiro, and she's a plus 340 underdog. Goes 0-3 to start her 3 UFC fights as a plus 440, a plus 315, and a plus 340. Poor girl. And they keep her on the roster. Booked her against Estella Nunes as a plus 185, and she got her first win. Booked her against Elise Reed as a plus 125, she gets her second win. Pierre Rodriguez, she's a plus 145 underdog, loses that one. And then her last time out against Jacqueline Amorim, a plus 220 underdog, and she cashes the tickets. But now all of a sudden, she's gotten away from this 0-3 start. She's 3-1 in her last 4 fights, and she's cashed 3 tickets as the underdog. So the thing with Sam Hughes is that she's pretty durable. Like, the debut against Tisha Torres, that's in the rearview mirror. Since then, she's fairly gritty, and she was never a great wrestler, but she's using a lot more wrestling, you know, heavy tactics, pressing her opponents against up the cage, fighting within the clinch, leaning on them, and just outlasting them. Elise Reed, you know, she can't wrestle for nothing, so that was not a great example. Estella Nunes is a good example. Jacqueline Amorim is a good example. They're actually very talented, but they're kind of one-round fighters. And the longer that you can drag them into those murky waters and you can dirty this fight up, you can fight your way into it. Sam Hughes can strike. She comes from that striking background, but it's that she's been using a lot more wrestling lately, getting a lot more comfortable. 31 years old, physically coming into her prime, coming off a big win. Like I said, 3-1 over her last 4 fights. I think that there's enough momentum to suggest that she's coming into this fight motivated to go out there and get the win. She has the skill to maybe make this a grinding affair, maybe turn this into a bog, maybe make this a 15-minute type fight, and then have some success. Yergui, meanwhile, because she's the huge favorite, so what exactly makes her that huge favorite? I'm not so sure. Like, Yasmin Lucindo, it's not a giant win, and she lands 86 significant strikes. She looked like a volume machine. But for 115-pound women, 86 significant strikes isn't exactly a volume machine. It's kind of par for the course. Her fight with Estella Nunes, she got dropped. She got rocked early. And then, as you mentioned, her last time out against Denise Gomez, she got knocked out. But you've not really seen her excel outside of that, you know, that first fight maybe against Lucindo, really excel in these hard 15-minute type fights. You've not seen an opponent take her down. You've not seen an opponent, you know, pose that big threat. And Sam's not exactly the big power puncher that I think I would want. If I was going to take that full fade of the big favorite, I would want somebody that might clip her, because as you mentioned, there's question marks there about that chin and about that durability. Sam Hughes doesn't exactly fit that bill, but her ability to fight a competitive 15 minutes and keep it a relatively close fight, have some spots, have some moments, maybe rock her, maybe tire her out, maybe allow the pressure to get to her, maybe just use a veteran performance. 7 fights in the UFC, you know, like, start to put it to good use. So if this thing was minus 240, Yergui, if it was minus like 300, I don't know, even then, man, like, I wouldn't want to pay 3-1, and this is worse than 3-1. So that's a no moss. It's no moss for me.
Yeah, that's fair. No, but the one thing I will say is, okay, the Lucindo is the only person who shot any takedowns on her, right? Lucindo has since went out and against Brogan Walker, got four takedowns. She took down Pollyanna Viana, and on top of that, was able to submit her, took her down twice, and then in round two, got an arm and triangle on her. So I don't know. Maybe Lucindo's takedowns are pretty solid, and against Wargi, she wasn't really able to get those going. That's really where my where the cloudiness, because the worst case scenario is Sam tries to shoot takedowns and just she gets stuffed. It's she's gonna get chewed up on the feet. I don't think it's remotely competitive if this is a 15 minute striking affair between these two. That would be my hesitation to pull a trigger. You know me, I want to pull the trigger on a plus 400 female underdog, but I don't know if I can pull the trigger. We'll see where the line goes. Maybe I'll FOMO into it.
Man, she's 24 years old, right? And she's from Mexico, who's not a country known for their wrestling. So yeah, I don't know. I could be way off on this one, but what suggests that she is yeah, you're right. Lucindo's maybe not terrible offensive wrestler, but I don't know. We'll tell. It's just the price. It's more of a price thing more than anything else.
I ain't betting the minus 520. I'll tell you that much. I ain't betting it. All right, we got Manuel Torres taking on Chris Duncan. Torres is a minus 190 favorite. Duncan can be had for plus 165. Who you got?
So this is another one I think I could be talked into maybe an underdog pick on Chris Duncan. It's going to be dirty, and it might blow up straight in your face like a hand grenade. But I think he's got a shot. Manuel Torres, like him. Like him because he's an offensive dynamo. Like him because he comes to just absolutely decapitate you. And decapitate you, he generally does. The vast majority of his wins are by first-round finish. His last time out against Nicolas Mota, just the filthiest elbow. But, you know, a knockout, sub 2 minutes. His fight with Frank Camacho, call Frank Camacho a little long in the tooth or not, knocking him out in less than 3.5 minutes, first round. Solid stuff. Colton Englund, not exactly good, but still, you see, if you're not on his level and you have durability issues and you're hittable, you've got problems, man, because he finds ways to sneak through. He carries a ton of power, and he's one of these Mexican brawler types where he's down to throw down. He's down to stand in front of you and just feed off the energy of the crowd. So you need to be able to fight that smart fight. The counter to that, it's like, oh, great, he's a first-round finisher, and he's got dynamo power, and what's the problem? The problem is, I'm not entirely sure he's able to keep it going, even though he's Mexican, and Mexico is not Mexico City, right? This is a part of Mexico that has altitude. So I'm not fully convinced that every single Mexican fighter on the card is going to be ready for it. There's going to be a lot of fatigue from these other guys. This is a first round finisher. He finishes guys in the first round. If he gets out of the second round, naturally, I would assume he's tired. Naturally, I would assume at altitude, he's going to be even more tired. So he needs to get a quick finish of Chris Duncan. Beyond that, he's got two career losses. Carlos Calvao, who's legend of the region, but it's a first-round knee bar, a minute 23. Two fights prior against Mahatmi Garcia, who was 9-8 at the time, it's a first-round heel hook in 59 seconds. So two things. You look at tape on him, he's not a great grappler. He's getting subbed by leg locks in a minute off these guys. Now, when you stand in front of him and you allow him to butcher you with elbows, he knocks you out. But if you want to grapple with him, he's not shown, at least on tape, he's not proven that his grappling's all that good. He hasn't proven that his cardio is all that good. Even the split decision loss to Enrique Gonzalez, he's gassed the longer the fight goes because he's an offensive dynamo, because he's putting pressure on guys, because he's swinging for the fences. So as much as a guy like this can win and does have that, there's risk reward, he's on a winning streak. He's taking these guys out. He's cashing these $50,000 bonuses. It's all good stuff. Somebody eventually is going to take advantage of him. Now, why he can win this Chris Duncan fight, yeah, he's got a puncher's chance against anybody, but Duncan is hittable, man. Duncan stands not right in front of you, but he's a guy that has a little bit leaky boxing defense, doesn't exactly keep his hands the best position, doesn't move his head off the center line a whole lot, and kind of comes on a linear line. So he's there to get hit. You saw his fight with Vlachislav Borshev on the Contender Series. If I'm not mistaken, he was I guess slight favorite, but he was the favorite over Borshev. And you saw that he's there to hit, play Rock'em Sock'em Robots with him. Only thing is, Slava Claus hits like an absolute tank. And every time Slava hits him, it does some serious impact. Whereas his return far is not getting that same respect. Eventually he melts over in the second round. since then, it's not like he's done anything, you know, to super wow you. This is more just like speculation than anything else. But he moved down to American Top Team and started putting in some solid time with Matt Brown or Mike Brown, sorry, and just like a bunch of the solid guys at American Top Team. Puts in the work, apparently is just big time work ethic, shows up to the gym every day, puts that grind in. And then to be honest with you, his last two fights, Omar Morales and this Yanel Ashmus, he's been wrestling way more. Five takedowns over Morales, two takedowns over Ashmus. Ashmus, he looked pretty fluid too. 85 significant strikes landed, you know, cardio checked up. Fight IQ actually looked a lot better. He wasn't necessarily willing to just stand and engage with a guy that was a fairly one-dimensional brawler. He fought a much better game plan. And so this lies why he would be maybe a decent underpick and worth taking this week against Manuel Torres, is if he gets in a gunfight, he probably gets curled over, if we're being honest with you. But if he comes in with this game plan of allow this guy to come forward, time it, take him down, make him carry your weight, make him, you know, feel that grind, let the crowd noise get to him, let the pressure get to him, let the lights and the heat, and it's possible that this guy's a one-round fighter to begin with, and his submission game's not very good.
No.
And you got a guy that's probably going to end up on top of him for long periods of time out of a hell of a camp with a hell of a game plan. And if he just follows what Mike Thomas Brown, the great Mike Thomas Brown, tells him, he has the skills to put his best foot forward and actually spring the upset. So I think dog number two, I'm going to go with Chris Duncan. But this is one of those underdog picks that sometimes you pick an underdog and they fight a really tough fight and it's a close decision and people pat you on the back like, oh, you got it wrong, but I saw where you were coming from. And sometimes your guy gets melted in the first round. It's the same. I'm going for something. It's either going to work or I'm going to look bad because my losing condition here is getting melted in the first 3 minutes. My winning condition is take this guy down, grind him, and hit that plus 190 plus price tag. So dog number two for me, I'll take Duncan.
I don't hate it. I don't hate it at all. The only thing that would make me like Duncan a little bit more of it is if he had some sort of like decent submission game. I know he has a couple of like submissions against absolute nobodies early on in his career, but like it's not quite there. But the fact that he's got the takedowns, I mean, the Ashmus fight was just like a great performance by him all the way around. He really career ramped best. It up too early on. He's like, this is when this guy's the most dangerous. His significant strike count in that round one was 19 significant strikes. He still made sure that he didn't get hit. He only absorbed, you know, 9 out of 28. So it's like he minded his P's and Q's early. And then every single round, 26 significant strikes in round two, 40 significant strikes in round three. Kind of let the fight come to him. Didn't get into a gunfight early. The chin could be an issue. He absolutely 100% could get melted in this spot. But yeah, I mean, he's got at ATT with that camp. I mean, it doesn't seem like that bad of a spot all the way around. They'll have him ready for altitude. Like, I know he trains in Florida. It's like, obviously, but it's like, he's shown that it's like he has a propensity to, since at least going to that camp, to ramp the volume up the later the fight goes when you're supposed to be more tired. So I don't know. Everything's kind of pointing upwards for him. The Ashmus obviously has power and wasn't able to really do much with his strikes that he did land. I mean, Omar Morales can't really bust a grape. So that, I wouldn't read too much into it. It's going to be, he's going to, yeah, make that fight ugly early. Don't need some sort of like helicopter kick or like spinning back elbow or something like that. It's like, it's definitely on the table. MMA is going to MMA, but I'm with you. Duncan, plus 165 is a fine underdog pick as far as I'm concerned. We got your boy, Rowney Barcelos, taking on Christian Quinones. Rowney Barcelos is a minus 200 favorite. Quinones can be had for plus 170. Who do you like?
I got to go with my boy, Rowney Barcelos. Normally, because I'm a big Rowney Barcelos, you know, fanboy, and I don't love the fight, but I love Rowney. But in this case, I actually do really like the fight, and I like Rowney. He's obviously on the back nine. He's obviously regressing. His boxing's not as sharp as it used to be. His cardio's not as tight as it used to be. His wrestling's not, you know, nearly as, you know, fluent as it used to be. Father Time's kicking his ass. The thing is that he's still got a legitimate skill set and it could be applied against these weaker low-level guys. If you look at Roni, he used to fight lower-level guys and kill them. I mean, we're talking Carlos Guation. We're talking Chris Gutierrez. Before Chris Gutierrez got good, I guess. You know, Khalid Taha, Trevin Jones can beat those guys. It's Timur Valiyev, Victor Henry, Umar Nurmagomedov, Kyler Phillips. Clearly, he's not going to be able to get over that, you know, top 10, you know, upper echelon, be considered a fringe contender. He's just going to be one of these tough top 15 type guys that's going to be a gatekeeper. He's going to fall into the gatekeeper type position. When I look at Christian Quinones, it's almost like, you know, he could potentially be a fraud. He had fought a lot of salty guys on his way up, you know, guys on the regional scene that maybe were unheard of or just didn't have that level of experience, but he's been finished in all of his fights. This Jose Rallo Soto fight, the guy was 2-2. He knocked him out. Christian Souza, he knocked him out. Victor Madrigal choked him out. And then his last time out against Mr. Perfect, Kyoho Hang, he actually got taken down, knocked down, and rear naked choked. So that was the trifecta. His chin's not that good. You and I talk about these cast iron Mexicans with his ability to take damage. But just like, you know, every stereotype, it's just a stereotype. It doesn't fit everybody. Some people genuinely can't take a punch. Quinones might be in the category of Mexicans who cannot take a punch. Beyond that, his takedown defense is really not all that good. His grappling's really not all that good. And he's got a bad habit of giving up his back. Roni's not as sharp as he used to be, but in terms of his technical boxing, he's way sharper in the pocket than Quinones. He's got, I wouldn't say maybe the faster hands, but he's got good counter-punching abilities. Quinones throws out a long, lazy jab. Barcelos is going to counter it over the top. If he hits him clean, he's putting him down. Even if he doesn't hit him clean and put him down, the wrestling's still there, man. Seven-time member of the Brazilian national wrestling team. 100% that single leg's going to be on display. He's going to rip him to the ground. Once he rips him to the ground, Quinones tends to give up his back, and Roni loves to take the back. You know, beat Said Nurmagomedov. The guy's got legitimate skills when he puts them to his best use. It's just fighting the best guys in the world is splitting hairs. Like, one mistake is going to cost you. Against Quinones, I think he can make a handful of mistakes and probably still win the fight. So, yeah, I like this spot for Roni, and I can't put him on the top line because he's lost my, he's my boy. He's lost my faith of putting like everything all in on him. Can't do that anymore. 100% I'm playing him. And again, with Quinones, it's like, what's his big win? Khalid Taha, Roni killed that guy too. What's his other big win? I don't know. Guys on the UWEC Mexican regional scene that never broke on to any other scene after that. Like, maybe I'm being too harsh. He's 27. You know, he's got a long jab on him. Maybe Roni is shot to bits and just doesn't got it in him anymore. But I would honestly still take a shot to bits Roni Barcelos than the best version I've seen yet of this kid, Christian Quinones. So bias aside, you know, love affair aside, I think Roni Barcelos is the better play.
Yeah, Quinones seems pretty KO or bust here. I mean, here's a fight that, like,
KOing Roni would be a hell of a task. Like, yeah, Umar, yeah, and those guys, maybe.
Yeah, but Umar, who's arguably the best guy in the division. I mean, nobody wants to fight him. No, but I'm saying, like, that. But, like, here's an example of a fight that, like, you know, people are like, oh, you know, Roni could KO him, or, like, you know, Trevin Jones has that death touch. Yeah, he basically completely neutralized Trevin Jones in that entire fight. Like, it was really not competitive whatsoever. It was able to take him down when he wanted to take him down. I mean, one on significant strikes, 73-11. Roni's a little bit long in the tooth, but all of the skills are there. I'd like to see him mix in the wrestling, just at least early in the fight, just to kind of, you know, take that the riskiest time of this fight out of the kid's hands. But I'm with you. Roni seems like a fine parlay piece at -200 to me. We got Matheus Mendonca taking on Jesus Aguilar. -150 for Mendonca, +130 for Aguilar. I mean, you can't see the graphic right now, but if this Matheus Mendonca didn't have, like, you know, fancy blue hair, you know, and, like, kind of cool tattoos, I mean, what has this guy done to be justified as a favorite? I know Jesus Aguilar, historically, doesn't really have much power. He did knock out Shannon Ross, but Cody, you could knock out Shannon Ross if you were just allowed to like line up and overhand right. I have a lot of faith. Yeah, like, I mean, the performance last time out was absolutely abysmal. I don't know. I think this guy's an absolute goof. Why would we bet him as a favorite literally against anybody at this point? Aguilar, for me. What about you?
Yeah, so Mendonca's actually a bit of a he's a bit of a wild card, you know. There's what do you know about him? So one, he's 25 years old. He's still super young. Again, we always go back to the whole a guy that should be making improvements, but he's one of Charles Oliveira's boys. Like, he's a straight up teammate. Why his hair is blue and not blonde? I don't know. Maybe he didn't want to, you know, copy Charles's thing, but he very much wants to be like a poor man's Charles Oliveira. He wants to just be an offensive dynamo, put heavy pressure on you, you know, long rangey, explosive striking, get it, eventually close up that distance, grab a hold of his opponents, peel them to the ground, overpower them. What he lacks up in technique, he makes up in raw aggression, and just attack submissions. Attack. That's what he wants to do. I'll be honest with you. When he came on the Contender Series against Ashiak Ajim, he just folds the guy in 48 seconds. He's an offensive powerhouse. They book him against Javid Basharat. He looked pretty good against Javid Basharat. Taking on a credible opponent, he landed two takedowns. Yeah, he got tripled up in the significant strike department, but he looks like he is a physically strong guy who's still young, needs time to mature, but the takedowns are going to be there for him. And again, he's going to be able to just go out there and out-muscle guys and put them in bad spots. So his fight with Nate Maness, it's crazy. He goes 15 full minutes with Javid Basharat and takes him down two times. Very ultra impressive, okay? Does this all, Paul, at 135 pounds. Drops down to 125 against Nate Maness. Every indication would be a better version of him. And I have no idea what he was thinking. But his entire game plan was grab this guy's leg and hold on to it at all costs. And even though Nate Maness is punching him in the head, and even though he's clearly not defending himself, and even though the leg lock is clearly not working, the first three of them have not materialized. Just he had zero ability for his brain to just connect the dots and be like, bail on this game plan. No. He just sat there and allowed himself to get punched in the face until the referee finally said, I'm sick of seeing you get punched in the face while holding onto Nate's leg. And that was it. He gets knocked out tail end of the first round with just the world's worst game plan. Like, at least Husam Al-Pahars could break a guy's leg. At least Ryan Hall could use it to scramble into a new position. Like, Mendonca just looks so lost, man. So lost. And so here's a guy that actually looked decent on short notice against a good opponent in Javid Basharat at 135 pounds, who looks completely lost and just not with it in his second fight against Nate Maness at 125. Two fighters, man. That's why it's hard to get a read on these guys all the time. But in Mendonca's case, it's like, I wouldn't want to put any stock. I think he's got skills. And I think fighting the right game plan could yield him some success. But I got no confidence and no faith that he's actually going to go there and do that. And for that reason, I really can't get behind him. Jesus Aguilar, meanwhile, is not like the sexiest play going. Short underdog here. One thing I will give him that I like about this guy is that he's one of your I can fight for 15 minutes and I ain't going nowhere type of Mexican fighters. He's got legitimate wins over Edgar Chavez, who we're going to talk about a little bit later. But he choked Edgar Chavez out with a guillotine choke in the fifth round of a title fight in Mexico. Fifth round, never quits coming, catches him in a nasty guillotine choke, solid. He follows that up beating Jamie Alvarez. Jamie Alvarez is one of the original flyweights out of American Top Team, a little bit older now. Solid guy, fought in the Contender Series, been around the block more than a few times. He catches Jamie Alvarez with a guillotine choke, second round, beats Christian Barraza by unanimous decision, beats this Arison Ferreira on the Contender Series, another guillotine choke, obviously is his favorite move, in the third round. These are all late finishes. Tatsuya Taira is a beast. Clearly he can't grapple with Taira. He gets caught in triangle armbar. And then Shannon Ross can't take a punch. So, like, you don't, what do you know? He landed a punch 17 seconds in. I don't know. What I do know is the grappling, is the cardio. And I think that makes sense, is that Mendonca wants to get this fight to the ground. He tried against Javid. He tried against Nate Maness. It's what he'll want to do here, too. It's possible in the Nate Maness fight that he had a bad weight cut because he looked like he had some cardio against Basharat at 135. No cardio against Maness at 125. So, again, now you're dropping down, again, with a tough weight cut. going to Mexico City to take on the local guy who he's got cardio for days. He'd be choking guys out 25 minutes into a fight. He's still choking guys out. He's got cardio for days and a pretty decent submission game. If Mendonca doesn't catch him early, I'm not 100% sure he does. This looks like a prime spot for Jesus Aguilar just to tire him out or just fend off the submission attempts, end up on top, make him carry your weight, tire him out, and then put that beating on him. So good live betting opportunity here for Jesus Aguilar in that he may lose the first round. He may get overpowered to the ground. He needs to survive that initial onslaught. If he does, he's live underdog. So short underdog right now, probably a better price after the first round. In both scenarios, I'll take the short price here and make him underdog number three for the card.
I will say, yeah, there's actually the plus 130 that's like on the board doesn't even really exist. Updated the odds right before we started the show. It's like other people are seeing the kind of the same thing. It's like clearly the more like dangerous guy is going to be Mendonca. But like if he doesn't get him out of there, doesn't, you know, land something absolutely enormous or find a sneaky submission, seems like it's going to be a grindy affair. Grindy affair would favor Jesus Aguilar. And we got a Brazilian fighting a Mexican-American. I have to imagine, the crowd will, side with the guy named Jesus Aguilar, even if he is from, like, the U.S.
He's born in Mexico.
Is he born in Mexico? But I think he's, like, he doesn't really seem like Mexican-Mexican, right?
Like, I mean, his name's Jesus Aguilar. How much more Mexican would you want to be?
But, like, he's not, like... he speaks English. I believe he grew up stateside, didn't he?
California. No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. He's okay. Mexican-American, but I think like his birthplace is Mexico. And so that's why people be like, oh, man, you're Croatian-Canadian. It's like, I'm going to shoot it to you straight here, dog. I've never been to Croatia. I'm born in Canada. My parents are born in Canada. I'm Canadian, right? Like you got roots and you got heritage and you got ancestry, but... I myself am Canadian. I don't know what else I could tell you. In this case, it's like, yeah, Mexican American. He lives in the United States. He probably grew up in the United States. Born in Mexico, that makes him Mexican. And I'm sure his parents are also born in Mexico. So seems pretty straight up. But what I noticed about the Canada card is that even though you're in Canada and it's Canadians, the guys that are judging the fights, it's still Saul D'Amato. It's still Chris Lee.
Oh, yeah,
it's still just the bums from Vegas or California or wherever. They send them on assignments to these places. So like you might get one local judge sprinkled in with two notoriously bad judges. It takes home cooking off the table. And even if it's like, oh, crazy crowds behind you, every time the Canadian lands, the place goes nuts. They don't care, dude. How did Siri City lose that fight to Ramon Tavares? The guy missed weight by 5 pounds, and City outlanded him 2-1 in the second and third round with a crazy crowd. They don't care. They don't care. So, yeah, I'm trying to not play the hometown cooking angle, but I'm glad I have the local guy. Just in case that angle is on the table, I'm going to be part of it. I can't rely on it anymore, Paul Shaughnessy. Few years back, made money just betting the local guys in these cards and waiting for the bad decision. Nowadays, you just don't seem to get those same bounces.
Because now they have bad decisions everywhere.
It's everywhere.
They spread the wealth around, you know?
Oh,
yeah. But yeah, home cooking doesn't... I would say... you never know. I would say, like, in fairness, a lot of these cards, too, it's like... because of COVID and stuff, there was like a lot of cards, particularly the ones at the Apex. Maybe that's like blinding us a little bit. You don't really have crowds and that type of influence. Maybe it's a little bit harder. I don't know. I don't have any numbers or math. It's just I'm going straight with my feelings on this one. I don't know if home cooking's completely dead, but yeah, I feel like in the UK there could be an advantage in some spots there. I don't know. It's nonsense. Anyway, let's move on. We've got another rematch. A fight that's been booked a third time here. Chirez taking on Lacerda. Chirez is a minus 360 favorite. Lacerda can be had for plus 285. I mean, me and you were actually watching UFC Noche when we were at your cottage. We were together, me, you, Pogi Rob, the actual Pogi Rob, the namesake of the Pogi Rob parlay, the PRP, for all the people who ask all the time, what does PRP mean? It's the Pogi Rob parlay. Rob asked for it and then bought his dad a car one time. Good times.
Pretty sweet.
Pretty sweet. I mean, that was a ridiculous, stoppage, right? Or it was a ridiculous ruling as far as I'm concerned. Like, it kind of, it looked like Lacerda tapped. Somehow he got, you know, the powers that be to kind of agree with them. So they were like, all right, no contest. We'll run this thing back. Run it back. And then Lacerda pulls out with an injury and they're like, you're not getting off of this one, bro. Now we're flying you out to Mexico City. You're fighting this guy in his home country. I mean, Lacerda seems like a one-trick pony. Chiarez seems pretty durable. Chiarez seems to have some sort of grappling advantage over him here. It's hard for me to pull the trigger on Daniel Lacerda, to be perfectly honest. But with the numbers the way it is, I really don't see too much like value hashtag, or like meat on the bone here. The under is absolutely nuked to like minus 215 to the under 1.5. Like, I don't really know how to approach this one from a betting perspective, but I don't know. I don't think Lacerda typically, outside of some of his performance, I mean, I guess the Chiarez fight, he was kind of like minding his P's and Q's, but like the only reason why he's kind of hung around this long is that all of his fights have been absolutely nuts. So, I think, yeah, I think Chiarez, I think most people in the UFC is a bad fight for him. He hasn't really shown me much reason to back him with my money. So I'll back Chiarez for a pick, but I don't know what to do with it from a betting perspective. What about you?
Yeah, it's getting tougher and tougher because Chiarez, love Chiarez. In this matchup, love Chiarez. First time he fought Lacerda, it was like it was an even money fight, but I loved him in the first matchup. Point being that Lacerda, all of his fights, first round finish, first round finish, first round finish, first round finish. This guy is fast. He is legitimately fast. He makes guys that are fast look slow. He's got speed. Unfortunately, it's like he's moving in such quick motion that he just gasses himself out. Not only does he gas himself out, I don't think he particularly has much of a heart, for being honest with you, but he's got about 3 minutes. He will throw a spinning wheel kick. He can absolutely knock your head off. If he does not take you out in the early 2-3 minutes, he completely falls apart. Now, keep in mind, this is a guy that Jeff Molina beats him 46 seconds into the second round. Has that first round. Soon as it's time for round two, this is uncharted territories for him because he never fights beyond a round. And Jeff Molina takes him less than a minute into the round. Francisco Figueiredo, you may have heard the last name Figueiredo. Yeah, this is his untalented brother. Did I mention the untalented part? Because he's very much untalented. Yeah, first round knee bar, like a minute 17 into the round. So now this guy, yeah, geez, he can't really take a punch. Can't really sustain any type of offense. His grappling's really not all that good either. Gets Victor Altamirano, who we'll talk about a little bit later. Altamirano's a generalist. He doesn't excel in any one area. He's not great in any one area, but he's there. He's tough. He wants to fight. And he's a guy that could fight for longer than 3 minutes. So when this fight goes longer than 3 minutes, Altamirano takes him down, crown and pounds him out. He's having no success. The UFC gives him a fourth fight. Why? Nobody knows. CJ Vergara. And wouldn't you know it, he actually looked a little bit better against CJ Vergara. Made it 4 minutes into the second round. Longest he's been. Pretty solid stuff. But ultimately, same thing. He tires out. Vergara is one of these, not the most talented guys, but junkyard dog, man. Puts pressure on you, comes forward. Those type of guys are going to yield tons of success against Lacerda, who's a front runner. And is not going to be there at the tail end of the second round. So again, it's another spot. He's now 0-4 in the UFC. You sign a four-fight entry-level deal. So he would have lost all four fights on his deal and somehow got re-signed and fights Edgar Chiarez. To me, that's craziness. But the first time he fought Edgar Chiarez, he was a plus 185 underdog. The second time he got booked to fight Edgar Chiarez, he was a plus 225 underdog. And now this time he's a plus 280 underdog. So people are realizing the same thing. He's just not good. He's the kind of guy that would look real good in Shooto Brazil. Or like the kind of guy that could like beat a lower level guy in like spectacular fashion on a dirty prelim somewhere, but like there's no actual sustainability there. And could he win this fight? Yeah, he could win this fight, but his win condition is he needs to win this fight almost right away. Now keep in mind the first time, the only time he fought Edgar Chavez, he did take Chavez down right off the get-go. He looks fast as he always does. He closes the distance. He gets a hold of Chavez. He throws him to the ground. He had a good start. The takedown was relatively effortless, but it was effortless because this dude's physically strong for the first 3 minutes. Yeah, he throws you to the ground. As soon as the fight hit the ground, you knew he's going to have to get something right away or he's just going to gas himself. And the longer that fight progresses, all of a sudden, Chavez turns the tables. All of a sudden, Chavez is the one landing punches. All of a sudden, Chavez grabs a submission. And I totally thought he tapped. You and me and Pogi Rob were all high-five and celebrating our... Yeah, and it's just like, no, 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 no. And now here's a guy that should be 0-5 in the UFC. Not only should he be 0-5 in the UFC, but he also canceled a fight with Vinicius Salvador after missing weight by 4 pounds and getting sick at the weigh-ins, and canceled his last fight against Edgar Chavez the day before the weigh-ins after he also got sick. He's not even a flyweight. He can't cut weight. He has no cardio. Now you're sending him to Mexico City of all places. Like, dog, none of this is getting any better for him. As I say that, I'll put Chavez on the top ticket and he'll eat a flying knee or something stupid because it's the game we play. But, like, there's honestly very little redeeming quality to Lacerda other than, yeah, dude, he'll give you a hard 2.5-3 minutes, come at you, you know, try to do the damn thing to the best of his abilities, but I got Chavez. And last thing I got to say is if it sounds like I'm a little bit salty, I'll tell you why I'm a little bit salty. The last time he was supposed to fight Chavez was when we hit the PRP last year. And it was a 12-fight card. It turned to an 11-fight card. And we went 11 for 11. And I smoked the biggest ticket of the year, clearly. But had they just fought, had Lacerda just manned up and showed up, Chavez would have kicked his ass back then. It would have been a 12-fight ticket. And even though he was like a plus or a minus 240, you know how 11... fight parlay tickets work, that minus 240 would have like tripled it, and Cody would be on an island somewhere right now. But he's not, because Lacerda's tum hurt and he couldn't handle the pressure. Well, now it's Chavez's chance to get one back over, and I hope he does.
Yeah, now you're just stuck with me breaking down the same damn fight again, right,
on a shitty webcam in 720p. Oh, what does the world come to? Like, I could go out and buy better technology. I'm so lazy. But had I won the 12-fight PRP ticket, I could have had an assistant who could have overcome my laziness and set it up for me. So, dumpster breaks, Paul. I'll just have to do it this week instead. Ah, goddamn Lacerda.
Yeah, if Lacerda showed up, Cody would have good internet. Think about that.
Anytime, no, where I live.
You've actually been pretty good.
You want
today.
Land?
You've been pretty
you
good. You've been
internet.
Pretty good in general today, to be perfectly all honest. Good. No complaints from here. But yeah, it's like if you ever see, I've seen actually people actually complain. They're like, why is producer Megan slowing down his like audio and speeding it back up? It's just like, I don't, you've never
Switching
seen,
internet.
You've never seen somebody lag before. Like I've seen that actually before, like producer Megan catching strays from people who, I mean, I would love to live where you live because obviously nobody ever has an internet issue by any stretch of the imagination. But yeah, it's all Daniel Lacerda's fault. Cody would have, you know, streamlined. I don't know. He'd live at the damn internet company. He'd buy the damn internet company if he just showed up, if that PRP hit. I mean, it was going to hit. Lacerda, he's there for a good time, not a long time, but like... It's one of those things. I mean, he's like Sam Alvey now. It's like he must know where like the bodies are buried. Like, not many people get this many opportunities. Let's just say that. Yeah. Moving on down, we got Farah Zayam taking on Claudio Puelas. Zayam is a minus 210 favorite. Puelas can be had for plus 180. I mean, when's the last time Puelas fought? Because, like, here's the problem with him. In the modern day of MMA, everyone can kind of do a little bit of everything. And if we've learned anything from Puelas, is he seems like a one-trick pony at this point. The volume on the feet and the stand-up is pretty non-existent. I guess it's been almost a year and a half since his last fight. That was a pretty ugly performance against Dan Hooker. Got absolutely battered when they were on the feet. Wasn't able to get, you know, his patented knee bar. You know, threw in a few attempts to try to do so. But, like, once that, if you have the defense to that, he doesn't seem to have very much answers. Now, it has been a year and a half. He is pretty young. He's not that young, but he's, like, young enough that I'm sure he's working on the – he's only 27 still. I'm sure he's working on other game – or other stuff at this point. But Ziam's kind of showed some pretty significant improvements outside of losing by rear naked choke to Terrence McKinney, who came on early and found that submission, as Terrence McKinney does, which I suppose is the risk of the Puelas fight here. Against Michael Figlock, who was like a well-touted European standout, did very well, showed like an evolving game, wrestling, takedowns, obviously pretty long, decent cardio, and he seems to be like, has most of the tools altogether there. So he seems to be a guy on the rise here. Until further notice with Claudio Puelas, I kind of look at him as a one-trick pony. And it's not like way back in the day we had like Ian Entwistle and those kind of guys. It's like the game has evolved so much at this point. It's like if you only have a couple tricks, it's like you get exposed pretty fast. And I feel like that's what's happened with Puelas. Maybe he comes out and we're like, okay, he's putting some of the other pieces together. It's very possible at his age after the beating he took against Dan Hooker, but for... You know, I can only kind of judge what I've seen at this point, and what I've seen is, I think, fair as I am, will mind his P's and Q's, stay out of those types of positions, and probably box him up on the feet. What's your take here?
Yeah, I'm going to agree. So Puelas is a guy that was fighting in the UFC. He was like 21 years old, and then 6 years later, he's now 27. There really is no evolvement to his game. Like, he hasn't gone to the next, he hasn't progressed to that next stage. The wrestling is still fairly rinky-dink. You know, not terrible, but pretty rinky-dink. Striking, yeah, the volume's not there. The power's not there. You know, the comfort is not there. And he's resorted to just going to these leg locks. Time and time again, you see the striking doesn't look any better. The wrestling, pretty well the same. And he goes to these leg locks. If he gets the leg lock, yeah, it's going to look good. If he doesn't get the leg lock, you mentioned Ian Entwistle. Yeah, great example. Because Husamar used to get them once in a while. But the guys that don't get them, like Ian Entwistle, and Matheus Mondonca, I don't know what the hell he was thinking. You can't just hang on to a leg forever and eat punches. It's not a great way of going about it. Now, keep in mind, Claudio Puelas, we actually watched this place at your place in Toronto in your basement, but Felipe Silva, he's getting annihilated. Like, his debut in the UFC was the Ultimate Fighter Latin America finale. He got knocked out by Martin Bravo. Knocked out by Martin Bravo, who never went on to much after that. Then the very next fight against Felipe Silva, 70 significant strikes landed by Felipe Silva, 2 knockdowns. The kid is just sitting on his butt. He looks desperate, and he rolls and he grabs the leg, and he caught him in the third round knee bar. Huge comeback win. It was like, oh, damn. And that became it. Keep in mind, he went to decision with that Marcos Mariano guy, Anderson Silva's buddy, who was a total putz, landing 22 significant strikes over 15 minutes. His fight with Jordan Leavitt, he decided to out-wrestle Jordan Leavitt, which I don't think is that impressive, truth be told, and he landed 20 significant strikes. His fight with Chris Grootsmacher, 43. His fight with Clay Guida, didn't really obviously need any, just grabbed that knee bar. He's become just a leg locker. The thing is that I don't think it's a sustainable game plan, and eventually you're going to run into these guys that are just going to put on heavy pressure, hit you in the head, break you down. Hooker is one of those guys. He actually also fought Ian Entwistle, and he did the exact same thing to him. Ian Entwistle dove on the leg. Hooker just folded into him, started landing ground and pound, softened him up, beat him up, caused him to quit. He did the same thing to Puelas. When you look at Fraz Ziam, he's 26. There is improvements from this guy. He's not like Puelas going through the motions. He come to the UFC. There's some serious holes in his game. He's a French Muay Thai fighter. He's long, but he's super flat-footed. He's got suspect takedown defense, and his volume's not all that good. He went 2-2 in his first four fights in the UFC, and they actually cut him. They cut him, but then they had a show in Paris, France. So they were like, who are our local French fighters? And they didn't have a whole lot. So they re-signed him for the card, gave him Figlak. He's a 2-1 underdog over Figlak. And he gave up 1 takedown on 5 attempts to Michael Figlak. His takedown defense looked a lot better. The very next fight against Jai Herbert, he stuffed all 6 of Jai Herbert's takedown attempts. You can 100% see in real time he's getting a lot more comfortable in there. His takedown defense is pretty solid. It's getting pretty solid. Because he's tall, he's using that tall man kind of don't let them take you off your feet. It's working for him. He's good up against the cage. He's got that slick Muay Thai, you know, that same slick ability to find the target that allowed him to beat Jamie Mullarkey, land the better punches. Only now he's starting to add more volume to it. That's the difference when you're fighting in the UFC at 23 to 26. You should be that much better. And you see him getting that much better. And in 4 years from now, when he's 30 and entering his prime, he's actually going to be pretty decent. Poilus has not made those improvements. He's relied on just grabbing the leg. Because when you got 3 wins by knee bar, it clearly works. It's what you're going to do. It's who you become. So could he grab a leg and pull off a knee bar? Like, yeah, it's certainly possible. But I think Zayam keeps the fight upright, lands the shots, slowly starts to hurt him, slowly starts to tire him out. I'm a little bit worried the French fighter at altitude. Normally his cardio is good. But at altitude, he could fatigue. And Puelas, even when he's fatigued, he's still going to be diving on legs. It does make him dangerous. It is a volatile fight. It's one you should probably pass on altogether. But yeah, we got to make a pick. So the pick is Frazaya.
All right, moving on down. We got Luis Rodriguez taking on Dennis Bondar. Rodriguez, a minus 120 favorite. Bondar can be average plus 100. Who you got?
Yeah, this would just be a quick play. I'm going to go with Bondar. He's a slight underdog, you said?
Yep. I mean, it's pretty much a pick 'em, but the market is moving. Like, Bondar opened as the favorite. And it's flipped slightly. Minus 120, plus 100. Yeah, so slight underdog, I suppose.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those fights that I would see as close, so it's almost like you would classify it as a dog or pass situation. But with Luis Rodriguez, he's got some proving to do. He's only 24 years old, so he's still young. This is his UFC debut, so it's a tough spot to make your debut. Still young, still green. He fought in the Contender Series, like 3.5 years ago against Jerome Rivera, and like didn't look good, truth be told. Loses, doesn't get a contract, obviously loses, and then goes back to the regional scene, and he's beaten some like lower level guys. It looks like takedown defense is a problem for him. It looks like he's not the biggest guy going. I honestly feel like, and cardio is also maybe a bit of an issue as well. His fight with Victor Moreno a few fights back, split decision win, you can 100% see him getting tired. And so with Dennis Bondar, I don't rate him. I don't think he's good at all. He has one of the worst records, like beating a lot of bad guys to build up a record, then comes to the UFC and has looked awful in the UFC. Lost to Malcolm Gordon, and then his last time out against Carlos Hernandez, he got knocked out with the second left. They can call it a headbutt all they want. He got knocked out with the second left. It's 0-2 in the UFC now. It hasn't been a particularly good run for him. But I'll admit, in that Carlos Hernandez fight, like, the guy is super aggressive. He comes forward and he swings. He's generally the one marching forward, and he kept a decent pace against Hernandez. A lot of these guys that are a little bit wild and erratic, they will tire. In his case, he didn't necessarily tire. He put some pressure on him. He landed the 2 takedowns. He was continuously coming forward. Unfortunately, Hernandez is someone that I think is a smooth operator, and he eventually caught him. So good win for Hernandez, but not necessarily a terrible performance for Bondar. When I think Bondar in this particular spot, yeah, I mean, I think if he's the one coming forward, he's a little bit bigger. He's a little bit more aggressive. He's going to be swinging those shots. His cardio, at least on paper, seems to be better. His forward pressure seems like it'll be effective enough. And he has the wrestling advantage. So he's got multiple paths to victory. Again, he's one of these guys that I don't trust. And now you're putting him at altitude in a spot versus a local guy. And, you know, it could fall off the tracks really, really quick. So do you want to put a ton on it? No. Do you want to have a ton of faith in it? Probably not. But I got a feeling that Bondar just marches him down, keeps coming forward, mixes in the takedowns. And if the judges are fair, then that'll be enough to win the decision.
I'll side with you, but I think this one's a pretty rifle coin flip, to be perfectly honest. I'm not the biggest Dennis Bondar guy, but what I see from Luis Rodriguez doesn't really impress me either. It's 13 fights on the card. I know you have to. I imagine Bondar's probably going to be pretty low on the PRP. Yeah. Could end up actually being the PRP pick, the actual bottom line. I don't think it's too far off, to be perfectly honest. Not really impressed with either one of these guys. Don't want to get too sunk in on betting either side here, but I'll pick Bondar for the purposes of this show. We got Felipe Dos Santos taking on Victor Altamirano. Dos Santos is a minus 300 favorite. Altamirano can be had for plus 250. I took some plus 600 Dos Santos by sub here. He subbed a bunch of guys on the regional scene. I mean, obviously, he came in on really, really short notice against Manel Kopp. And boy, oh boy, like, this kid's got skills. But I think, like, Altamirano, as we always say, he's Mexican. It's like, I think he can kind of take, like, I'm pretty sure from, you know, everything I've kind of seen, when you do finish him, it's typically by submission. He really doesn't, I don't believe he has any sort of knockouts on his record. I was eyeballing it earlier today. I was hoping another book that was going to open it up would open up a better price, but then they opened it up at plus 575. So I took the plus 600, just a small little thing. I mean, Jared Brooks found the rear naked choke against Altamirano before. And I think the biggest problem for him is that, like, his takedown defense is very, very suspect. Tim Elliott was able to get six takedowns. Obviously, Tim Elliott is a tremendous wrestler and had a lot more experience. But, like, Carlos Hernandez was able to get two takedowns. And then you go back to, like, that Candelario fight on Dana White Contender Series. They both got Robert. Takedowns, but, like, Candelario got five takedowns on him. It's like, I think that can be exploited here. Felipe Dos Santos may be like, I don't even want to wrestle, and maybe it never actually comes to fruition. But I think there could be a much easier path to a finish for him in the submission department. But, like, otherwise, love the kid. I think he looks super, super talented, but minus 300, it is a massive step up from, like, you know, they weren't expecting much from him. He came in, went way above expectations, lost a very, very close decision. Probably, like, not a robbery by any means, but, like, he performed great against a very legitimate, experienced opponent in Manel Kopp. Obviously, this is kind of a spot for him to, like, get back on track. Is it the classic letdown spot? I mean, potentially, but that's why I'll get my fill on the plus 600 by sub. What are your thoughts on the money line here at minus 300?
Yeah, the money line seems a little bit much because it's a flyweight fight. In these flyweight fights, you see time and time again, they are usually very competitive. There's tons of stuff going on. Both guys have decent gas tanks. It just ends up being a lot more competitive than you'd want for this type of money line. But if you want, like, a greasy, low-key sprinkle, haven't put anything on it myself yet. I don't even know the price, but you'll look it up for me right now. But What would be the Felipe Dos Santos by knockout?
Knockout. Well, KO. Best on market is plus 540.
Yeah, that's crazy to me.
That's a good number. Santos, the other book that has props open is they opened it at plus 375 and it moved down to plus 300 already.
Yeah, clearly people are seeing the same thing I'm seeing. But Felipe Dos Santos doesn't show knockout wins on his record. He shows a bunch of submission wins on his record. And Victor Altamirano's never been knocked out. But when you watch tape on both these guys especially, you get a serious impression that Felipe Dos Santos is about to catch him with something and knock him out. Altamirano, on the one hand, it's like, oh, he's never been knocked out. You know, Mexican, you guys talk about that durability. That's fair, but keep in mind, Tim Elliott is not a power puncher. Vinicius Salvador is not really all that good. Daniel Lacerda is a power puncher, and Daniel Lacerda dropped him. Landon hurt him. Carlos Hernandez is not a power puncher. Carlos Candelario, straight-up grappler. Nate Smith, straight up grappler. Chris Ocon, grappler. Jared Brooks, grappler. All of these guys are grapplers. When you watch him in there, dude, he dips and he dives and he puts his head in harm's way. Like, someone's going to boot him right in the face. It is going to happen, and it is going to happen soon. Like, he's getting away with it because he's taking on wrestlers and grapplers. But one of these, like, sharp, explosive guys is going to catch him bobbing when he meant to be weaving, and it's not going to go well for him. And that's kind of what I think happens here. What Candelario has two things. Or, sorry, not Candelario. What Altamirano has is two things. He's got volume, and he's got that ability to mix in the wrestling. The thing with mixing in the wrestling is Felipe Dos Santos, although Manel Kopp did take him down on his only takedown attempt, the guy's got good scrambling abilities and a good ability to get back up. So if Altamirano goes with that game plan, he himself doesn't have great top control, taking on a guy that's hard to hold down. Those takedowns are not going to bear a whole lot. Like, you, he might hit the deck for 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 5 seconds, but if he gets back up, it's going to be a problem. Then Altamirano's got to go to plan B, which is land the volume. The thing is, when he lands the volume, is he's like a poor man's Diaz brother. Like, he's just pawing stuff out. He's there to get countered. He's a tad bit slow. He's a tad bit hittable. And I don't think he's the most durable guy going. 33 years old, not old, but it's old for flyweight, man. This other kid he's fighting is 23 years old. He's 10 years younger than him. He took his debut against Manel Kopp, a top five contender, on like a week's notice, replacing Kai Kara France, a former title challenger, and landed almost 100 significant strikes on the guy. So with a full camp and more maturity and like just going to keep getting better. And Altamirano, meanwhile, I don't know if he's going to be like the most competitive guy going. He's falling into like journeyman gatekeeper type status. But that being said, his fight with Carlos Candelario on the contender series, I thought he lost. They gave him a split decision and it was a close fight. His very next fight is his UFC debut against Carlos Hernandez. He loses a split decision in a fight that people thought he had won. He has the ability to keep these fights close. If it goes 15 minutes in Mexico, it's a bad price tag to be betting Felipe Dos Santos based on he looked good in a losing effort in his debut. You know who else looked good in a losing effort in their debut? Mentus Mendonca. And then in his next fight, he dropped down a weight class and got a full camp. Brain dead stupid. I don't know if that was offensive to anybody, but just the guy's not smart, not smart. Maybe he'll be better this time around. What I'm saying is sometimes we get caught in this lull of like, dude, the guy lost, but he looked good in his debut. You expect more of them, and it doesn't necessarily happen. I do think Felipe Dos Santos is the real deal. I do expect something out of him, but I might be foolish. I might be setting myself up for disappointment by playing this number, or at least playing this number and having a whole lot of faith in it. I think he wins. I think he should win. But I wouldn't completely write Altamirano off as having no chance.
Well, I bet it at plus 600 when we were literally starting to talk about it. And they moved it to plus 500 by the end of you talking about it. So I move lines. I already won, Cody. I got
CLV,
100.
Dog. CLV.
CLV. It's like, I did my job. I won. That's how it works, right? I can pay my bills.
In both ways.
Can I feed my dog with CLV? Asking for a friend. All right, finally, we've got Muhammad Naimov taking on Eric Silva. Muhammad Naimov, a minus 450 favorite. Silva can be had for plus 350. Who you got?
Honestly, this should be straightforward, right? You have a massive favorite in Naimov. Naimov's been looking really good. Eric Silva is really not all that good. It just seems like a straight up, you know, foregone conclusion. And it probably is. But I got like this like nagging little, you know, the devil on my one shoulder and the angel on the other. Like there's something at the back of my mind being like, make Eric Silva the PRP pick, dog. Not a whole lot of investment, but if it hits, it's going to skyrocket the price on these things. And he's got a shot at winning. It don't look sexy, but it is possible. So with Naimov, of course, the guy is a physical dynamo. He's coming off a pair of nice wins. He's still only 29 years old. He trains at altitude already over in Colorado. There's good stuff to like about him. In the Malarkey fight, he lost the first round, but he comes back and he melts Jamie Malarkey in the second. And his next fight against Nathaniel Wood, he gassed out and held on for dear life, but he got the takedowns. He got the wrestling. Here's what I don't like about him. First of all, the guy is a gas bag. Elevation or not, he's too physically strong. He fights like your typical Tajikistan fighter where he comes at you and he comes at you hard. But there's a lot of exerted energy in the process. A lot of these scrambles are just, you know, balls to the walls, 100%, 100%. Just 2 years ago, he's losing to Colin Anglin and Olivier Mourad. These are bad losses, and they're not that long ago. More troublesome than that is that Colin Anglin took him down three times. In his fight with Jamie Malarkey, he also got taken down three times. In his fight with Nathaniel Woody, got taken down twice. He'd be rocking a 57% takedown defense, and yet wrestling and being strong and physical, that's kind of his game. He doesn't have takedown defense. Now, people will say, well, dude, he's coming off a career best win over Nathaniel Wood. He cashed as a plus 265 underdog. He headbutted him, he eye poked him, and he grabbed the cage on multiple occasions. So he damn near cheated to beat Nathaniel Wood, first of all. Second of all, Nathaniel Wood is a bantamweight that moved up to 145 to fight Naimov. So yet Naimov was able to take down the bantamweight and hold him down for a bit. He still gassed in the third. He still almost got finished in the third, and he still had to resort to fouling the guy 3-4 times just to get the job done as a +265 underdog. And before that, his fight with Jamie Mullarkey, he got taken down 3 times in the first round and lost the first round.
And then...
Yeah, he was getting his ass kicked, and then he melts Jamie, who's kind of known for suspect chin right now.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at Nemov, it's a history of he's mad suspect. His cardio suspect, his wrestling suspect, his striking suspect. Is just, he's like, you know, he's one of these tough guys with a crazy last name that ends in an OV that you don't want to bet against. And because a lot of people probably took a bath, myself included, took a bath on him versus Nathaniel Wood, you remember it as being like, ah, dude, Nathaniel Wood's actually good. And this guy just beat him. And he beat Jamie Mullarkey. He is suspect, and he is waiting to get taken advantage of. Now, is Eric Silva the guy, 36-year-old Venezuelan fighter, 0-1 in the UFC? Like, the one thing I will give him is that the boy can wrestle. 100% this boy can wrestle. And when he comes over to the Contender Series and he takes on that Anvar Boynazarov. Boynazarov's a glory kickboxer, long credit, 300 Muay Thai fights, spends time at Tiger Muay Thai. Why would you want to stand with him? Eric Silva does, and he just juggernauts him to the ground, beats the crap out of him. First round TKO, smooth money. His fight with TJ Brown, this one's a lot more interesting. He did gas, and it was a sloppy fight, but he landed 3 takedowns. He landed in some really nice positions, but TJ Brown's a BJJ black belt. And TJ Brown, who doesn't have great cardio himself, is slick from time to time and has decent wrestling. Is a guy that's landed 7, 8, 9 takedowns on UFC opponents in the past. TJ Brown on a good day is serviceable. And I feel like Eric Silva fought a good version of him, had tons of moments. Unfortunately, TJ stuck with it. In this fight with Nemov, you see, TJ Brown can grapple off his back. He loves the front headlock. He can transition. Nemov, I think if you take him down, you could hold him down. And that's all Eric Silva has to do for 2 rounds. Now, will Silva gas? Likely. But Nemov will probably also gas. And Nemov's actually taking on a real size 145er here, so it's not going to be as easy as Nathaniel Wood. It's at altitude. There's just enough muddy in the water for that. I would not want to touch a 5-1 Nemov ticket. I don't know who set this line. I'm sure it got steamed to where it is right now. And sure, he could win. But for this price tag, I fade him and I put Eric Silva as a PRP pick. That would be the bottom level. 13 fight card means we're going to have six tickets and a last line PRP.
The line's getting more ridiculous, Cody.
Nemov's not good.
Nemov's minus.
Have to find out the hard way.
Bet Online has him at -575 now. People are steaming that. -575. When I made the boards literally before we started, it was -450. There is massive steam coming in on him. I suppose the concern would be Eric Silva, both of his losses coming by submission. Maybe that's a little bit of a problem for him, but you brought up good points. Like TJ Brown, like people don't love him, but like he is a black belt in BJJ.
Trains with Bryce Mitchell every day.
Yeah, got caught there. And then he got subbed by some dude in 2016. Obviously, this guy's got started very, very late in MMA.
Wrestling. Like he's 30, a wrestler, though.
Yeah, 36 years old. I don't know. It's I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I think it's a pretty clear dog or pass. I'm not interested in parlaying Muhammad Nemov. Guy who's low volume, you know, pulled the rabbit out of his hat against Mullarkey. Mullarkey took him down 3 times. You bring up a lot of good points there. Yeah, if you can just take him down, hold position, make it ugly. It's not like there's like any sort of home cooking on this thing. If anything, maybe Silva would get a little bit more fans down in that part of the world. Yeah, it seems pretty dogger pass to me. So things that I have bet, I took Prado KO1 +1300 because that sounds like fun to me. And I think Zell Huber's a little bit chinny, but a bet I'm expecting to lose. Took some of his KO prop +575 as well because, you know, I'd be floored if he got a second round knockout and I only had the round one ticket. Duncan, money line, +165. Felipe Dos Santos by sub plus 600. Got CLV on that one already, so I already won code. Parlay pieces that I'm interested in. I've got Moreno, Rosas, Barcelos, Chires, and Ziam. Haven't bet those, but those would be the pieces that I would kind of mix and match. Just a new thing I'm kind of adding to my repertoire this year. Those are like my most confident ones. I'm not stealing the PRP, but I've got my own guys that I kind of isolate, or like the chalk that I'm feeling better about this week. And Brian Ortega, I'm considering Brian Ortega, but I'll see where the market goes. I'll see what it looks like at the scales. Like, this line's been out for a while, so I don't feel like I would be missing very much. And maybe I'll pick up something in interviews this week and I'll back rate off of that. But I liked what I saw from him in the short window of time that their first fight happens. Like, I want him to fight exactly how he did there, just not have his shoulder pop out. Cody, hit him with the PRP.
This week we're going to go with Brandon Moreno, Brian Ortega, dog number one, Raul Rosas Jr. We're going to go with Daniel Zellhuber. I can't take two plus 400. I don't know what to say. I guess I'll go with Yeragui. I'm a coward. I'll take Yeragui. But I will go Chris Duncan. Chris Duncan's dog number two. Ronnie Barcelos, Jesus Santos Aguilar is dog number three. Edgar Chares, Faraz Zayam, Dennis Bondar is technically dog number four. Felipe Dos Santos. And then I will not be a coward and take Eric Silva. So, yeah, 500 dogs on 13 fights. Last week it was favorite city. Dog City's coming up eventually. Hopefully it's a five dog city this week, and we've got those five dogs. But beyond that, again, there's like some big plus money out there. So even if you can hit a couple of the underdogs, you can make it worthwhile. And then for me, yeah, it's similar to what Paul's saying, is just try to key in on your favorite three, four, five. Six is pushing it, but get to six. We hit six last week. We'd love to hit six again this week, but kind of zone in on who you like. And then again, I mean, there's certain guys on that Bellator card, like, that's MMA, dude. I don't want to jinx it, but like, how does Jason Jackson lose? I can't see it. I can't see it. But it's MMA, so someone's going to probably shit in the apple pie. Thing is, they don't always shit in the apple pie. Sometimes you get out scot-free. Hopefully, that's one of these weekends. So it's just like a fight fan's delight on Thursday, Friday, Saturday. All you're missing is a Sunday Fury FC show, and you pretty much have the royal flush right across the board. But yeah, tons of betting opportunities. So maybe just like see what you like, see what you're most comfortable with, what you're most confident in, and then go from there. But it's in Mexico. It's largely South American fighters. At the very least, this is going to be a really fun card, very entertaining card. But of course, the goal is always make money, and that's the most fun of all. So entertainment aside, hopefully we can make this one a profitable one. And a good one for the audience and ourselves.
Yeah, you could bet Jason Jackson, or you could bet Clarissa Shields at basically the same price.
What? Yeah.
I have no idea who she's fighting. I'm literally just looking at fightodds.io. Like, I have no idea what a Kelsey DeSantis is, but if she can grapple a little bit, that'll be a lot. Even just a modicum of grappling will make that a little bit sweaty, so... Yeah, pick your spots, as always. There's plenty of opportunity coming your way this weekend. So that is it for us this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. For producer Megan and Cody Saftick, I'm Paul Shaughnessy, saying goodbye and good luck. Oh, oh, oh.